Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Hey, welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Nadolski, with my co-host, Mr. Dr. No Myostatin Gene Nadolski, Carl Nadolski Jr. We have a really special guest today. They're all special, but this guy came from my chief scientific officer's lab. His name's Dr. Christian Rodriguez. He's at Pennington, one of our favorite places down in Baton Rouge, down in Louisiana, one of the biggest research centers for understanding obesity and metabolism. And he is working with Dr. Steve Heimsfeld, who people may remember. We talked about the BELIEVE trial with bimagrumab with semaglutide. And he's also working with Dr. Eric Ravusen, who's one of the big time metabolism researchers who has oftentimes worked with Dr. Kevin Hall, who is also on our podcast. Today, we're inviting him on because he has a new review talking about whether metabolically healthy obesity exists or not, and using some of these newer guidelines and clinical definitions of obesity. We have a podcast on this from a few years ago, but it'll be fun to have a nice little update with someone who's studying this directly. So welcome to the podcast, Dr. Rodriguez.
Thank you. I appreciate y'all having me.
Yeah. Okay. So a little bit of background. You did a master's and PhD with Dr. Grant Tinsley. And what were you studying with him?
Let's see. He's actually the reason I got into research. He was my first year of my master's. I had no idea what research was, what it entailed. And he was my advisor, and then he just asked if I wanted to help out in the lab. I almost said no. To this day, I tell him all the time, I was this close to saying no, because I just didn't know what it was. I said yes, and then for, 2 years master's, 4 years PhD, so 6 years, I just started learning all about body composition, metabolism as well. And for the most part, we did a lot of, methodological work, looking at, how accurate are these devices? How valid are they? How reliable are they? Standardization, is it important? Like, if we let these people drink water, is that important if we let them exercise? But my dissertation, so I have this interest in, I guess you could say, physique, sports, bodybuilding. I've always had that interest for a while. Dr. Tinsley knew about that. And my dissertation was in muscular resistance trained adults, which is like the scientific way, I guess, for saying these people were jacked. We wanted to try to get the most jacked people in. And we tried to use as strict of a criteria as we have seen. Like, I haven't seen anyone use this strict of a criteria, because we wanted to actually be able to say these people were resistance trained. And Dr. Tinsley was in my study. I don't know if I can say that. I don't know if that's a violation of HIPAA or something.
He's fine. I don't care.
And he was in my study. He had the lowest amount of fat-free mass, the highest body fat percentage, just everything. I'm just kidding. He didn't. But so to qualify, because I'm pretty proud of these criteria. The manuscripts are in review right now, but to qualify, they had to have resistance trained 3 times per week for the past 5 years. No layoffs greater than a month within the last 5 years. No layoffs greater than 2 weeks within the last year. Males had to be below 20% body fat on DEXA, greater than 21.5 fat-free mass index. Females had to be below 27.5% on DEXA and greater than 17 fat-free mass index. and train like major body parts once weekly. So we got a lot of cool, and we did, it was natural and enhanced. So if they were enhanced, we didn't care. So we got some pretty cool people in that study. And we were essentially just trying to evaluate how accurate all these devices were in estimating body composition as compared to a multi-compartment, four-compartment model. So we had like 12 devices, and it was our first time doing deuterium dilution as well. So we had a criterion metal model for total body water assessment. We did RMR as well. So hopefully those results will be coming out pretty soon. And yeah, that's the gist of what I did with Dr. Tinsley.
That's amazing. Yeah, that sounds pretty cool. It sounds like my brother would have qualified. I may have, but
I think both of y'all would have qualified.
Very cool. Okay, so then you move over to Pennington. You go from Texas down to Louisiana, and you're working with some of these, like, these guys are like legends in the obesity world, Dr. Heimsfeld, Dr. Ravusen. And now you get away from bodybuilding into obesity, which is kind of, you know, that's like us. We're really into athletics, but we really are into obesity, trying to get people, you know, more towards the spectrum of, you know, the athlete level. And you start doing this, you know, metabolism, body composition with obesity. Is that right?
Yeah. So, I tell people all the time that my background, I'm a bro at heart. So I came up to watching all the people on YouTube, all the OGs on YouTube. That's how I got into lifting. And, but now I'm doing this work on individuals with obesity, and part of the reason I wanted to come here and do this type of research, one is of course Ravusen and Heimsfeld. Like, it sounds kind of corny, but to this day, every time I think about the fact that I get to work, or I am working with Dr. Ravusen and Dr. Heimsfeld, it's still pretty crazy to say. But also, I used to be someone with obesity, so I lost around 75 to 80 pounds.
Wow.
And good for you. If you know American football, I was an offensive lineman. I might not look like it now, but
wow,
I was blocking 350 pound guys. I wasn't driving them off the line. I was just keeping them from getting them.
You're keeping them from flying.
But so there's kind of that personal aspect of, I want to help other people with obesity as well and do research in those people. Now, here at Pennington, I have found this niche that we're about to start a study on a project, on a pilot and feasibility grant that I submitted and was awarded, and that was trying to study individuals with extreme obesity. And how we're defining that is people with a BMI 60 and above. So within the next month or so, I think my study will start, and we're going to do most of the procedures we're going to do. They have not been done before because no one really knows if you can do it. So I'm going to be putting them in the metabolic chamber. We're going to get energy expenditure, things like that. We're going to do a high fat test meal to test their metabolic flexibility. If we can do DEXA, we'll do DEXA. If they're below 450 pounds, we're going to do D3 creatine for skeletal muscle mass, doubly labeled water, accelerometry, questionnaires, all that stuff. And the idea is, these individuals, they're typically under researched. They're honestly kind of neglected because they're so large. One, they don't, surgeons and other researchers, they don't know if it's safe, like what they want to, if they want to actually research on them, they don't know if it's safe. So they just don't. So I'm trying to actually focus on them. With the overall goal of helping them, like the more we learn, I just want to learn more about their physiology, because the hypothesis is maybe this group represents a distinct subgroup that they're different physiologically, biologically than these lower BMI categories. And then we can figure out what is it that sets them apart, and then we can start helping them. Because when you look at the graph that shows the prevalence rates and you divide it by BMI categories, you're going to see like BMI 30, 35 or something. And it's kind of, maybe it's still increasing a bit, but it's almost straight now. It's almost plateauing a bit. You see BMI 60 and above, and it's going like this. And it's increasing at the quickest rate. So I want to see what we can learn about them. And
are you going to do genetic testing?
Yeah.
So, that's what I was about to ask. We just did our podcast on genetics.
We are taking blood and we're archiving it, and then going to do genetic testing and a few other things on those samples afterwards, because we know there's a genetic component. And we're pretty confident in that. And, you know, that's going to be very informative as well. And I've been very fortunate to have the support of two of our metabolic surgeons here. So they're like all for this project. They're supporting me however they can. And we also have a clinic here that's part of Pennington called Metamore that does metabolic surgery. So those surgeons are going to be helping me recruit from their clinic. So I'm really excited to see the data. And then from this point forward, it should be preliminary data to just keep going and see what we can start learning. I mean, the more people that jump in, once we can demonstrate like feasibility, the more people that jump in, the better chance we have of helping these people.
Very cool, man. Well, congrats with that.
Thank you.
We'll have to get you back on to talk about the results of that.
Thank you.
So you did a paper with Dr. Ravusen about whether or not metabolically healthy obesity really exists. My brother and I have done some papers and discussions on this. And one of my brother's mentors, Dr. Tim Garvey, has pointed out in the past how most definitions use metabolic syndrome. And you usually have to have three criteria of the metabolic syndrome to qualify for it, right?
Yeah, that's the historical, you know, criteria, which is why it was very confusing when they did these studies. But the shift over the past few years that you and I have talked a lot about, and I'm pretty sure it's more of an accepted harmonized definition, requires zero metabolic syndrome criteria to be truly metabolically healthy,
right,
in these studies for obesity, excluding, of course, the waist circumference correlating with abdominal obesity.
Yeah. So in your paper, you just did this review paper, you're trying to more, which makes way more sense of talking about more of like a spectrum and kind of using the new Lancet Commission. We did a whole podcast on the Lancet Commission. There are some things that we didn't agree with, like they don't have type 2 diabetes as a criteria, which doesn't really make any sense to us. So what did you guys talk about in this paper?
Yeah, so we kind of already mentioned part of it in that, there's this whole debate. Hopefully it's not too much of a debate anymore. Like, does metabolically healthy obesity exist still? And I would say there are two main, I guess, concerns with metabolically healthy obesity and those phenotypes. One, like y'all have already mentioned, there's just so many definitions out there. So many definitions. Some you can have up to two components of metabolic syndrome. Some you can have one. Some you can't have any. But because of all these different definitions, if you're trying to determine the prevalence of MHO or MUO, metabolically unhealthy obesity, they're just going to vary so much because of all these definitions. And then some don't use metabolic syndrome. Some might use, I've seen one that uses an indicator of fitness. Some use C-reactive protein. Some use the HOMA index. Some have self-reported measures just from the participants. And then these different definitions, some use different cutoffs as well. So there's just a lot of issues with the variability in the definitions. Then you have the stability of this phenotype, because as the research is consistently showing, metabolically unhealthy obesity is a transient phenotype. So if you assess someone today and you assess them in 5 years, there's a decent chance that they would, if they were metabolically healthy right here, they would be metabolically unhealthy over here. There's a pretty good chance. If you extend that and you assess them 10 years later, there's a really good chance that they'll be metabolically unhealthy over here. So I would say those are the two main concerns with really accepting metabolically healthy obesity, the whole notion of metabolically healthy obesity, because you can assess them at one point in time, and if they don't have any components of metabolic syndrome, okay, you can say they're metabolically healthy obesity. But time always goes on, so it's always going to continue, and they're likely going to transition. And the other thing is, metabolically healthy obesity, or just that whole construct, it doesn't address the other things that someone with obesity might experience that aren't just cardiometabolic. Something like sleep apnea, just daily limitations with activities of daily living, something with the liver, with the kidney, things like that. So it doesn't address those items as well. And so the paper kind of presents that first, initially just saying like, hey, this is where metabolically healthy obesity came from. These are some concerns with it. Maybe a decent idea is to transition to the Lancet Commission's definition, which they're trying to recognize obesity as a disease, recognize that excess adiposity might also contribute to some just negative effects on other domains of your body, or organ tissue domains, as they call it. So the CNS, the renal system, of course, the metabolic system as well, musculoskeletal system, things like that. So the Lancet Commission, to be classified as someone with obesity, there are four different ways. So the first one, if they have an elevated BMI, so if we're talking Europeans, a BMI greater than 30, and then at least one of the anthropometric criterion, so elevated waist circumference, waist to hip ratio, or waist to height ratio. The second way, or one of the other ways, is if you have a BMI greater than 40, then that's automatically considered classified with obesity or excess adiposity with the Lancet definition. The third one is if they're assessed by DEXA or BIA, but ideally DEXA, body fat percentage, elevated body fat percentage. And then the fourth one is they can have, let's say their BMI is like 26, an overweight BMI, so technically not considered elevated BMI, but they have two of the anthropometric criteria, so elevated waist circumference and waist to height ratio or something like that. And they can also fall into excess adiposity.
Did they ever give the specific body fat percentages of the DEXA? I feel like so that was an issue.
Well, that's always an issue in all our diagnoses, even in our algorithm or ACE thing. So it's hard. We don't have greatest data on that.
Yeah. So that's something I was wondering as well when I was looking through. And they didn't give an actual number from what I've seen. I could be.
Yeah, I don't remember seeing one.
But whenever I was, I think it's like table 3 or something that shows all the studies that have used the Lancet's definition so far. I noticed while reading some of them that they would use, it was 25% for males and 35% for females. So I don't know where they got it from, but that was any study that used it would use those two.
Got it. Okay.
Pretty typical.
So then, okay, so we got the kind of the anthropometric measures of adiposity. Mm-hmm. So then, and then you guys discussed then their criteria for like the clinical obesity.
Yeah. So if somebody has excess adiposity, then you move on to differentiating between preclinical and clinical obesity. And so you go through, you can call it 18 organ tissue domains, or you can say 12 because cardiovascular has 6 different ones. And you look through that those criteria. So in my review, it's table 2, has all the criteria listed. For children, there's 13. So for adults, there's 18. For children, there's 13. But you start looking through the criteria, and let's say we have an individual with excess adiposity. If they have just one of those 18, then they're considered as someone with clinical obesity. All they have to have is one. So for MHO and MUO, it was just, we can say it was just the metabolic syndrome components. For preclinical and clinical obesity, you have all these other domains, again, like the CNS, renal, and all that. Now, one of the things with the Lancet's definition is, one of the big differences is for the metabolic domain, it's not just if they have hyperglycemia or dyslipidemia, it's they have to have a cluster of hyperglycemia, dyslipidemia, and low HDL cholesterol. So if they have those three, then they satisfy the metabolic domain and they're someone with clinical obesity. If they just have hyperglycemia, but they don't have the other two, and they don't have any of the other domains, then they would be classified as being someone with preclinical obesity. So
this is where we really get into the debate and why I really wish you guys would have used the much better ACE obesity staging system.
Yeah, so
that makes the least amount of sense, and now everybody thinks that the Lancet Commission paper is not helpful because of stuff like that. It's nonsense.
Yeah. So while writing this, I learned a lot about all the other staging systems out there. And, you know, honestly, one of the things about writing this is Dr. Robinson was part of that commission that, you know, came up with the definition.
Mm-hmm.
So we kind of had to be strategic about how how much we kind of push back with the Lancet's definition, saying like, here are some concerns. Because while writing it, I definitely noticed some, we'll say, limitations with the definition. Like y'all mentioned, diabetes, the metabolic domain, like making it be a cluster as opposed to individual, that could be an issue. There were probably a few others that I'm blanking on right now, but one that was brought up was the waist to height ratio. So a lot of people use 0.5, and it seems like the 0.5 cutoff, well, it seems like there should be more specific cutoffs for certain, we'll say, ethnicities, things like that, because a blanket 0.5 cutoff doesn't transfer well to certain groups, certain subgroups.
Yeah, the problem with that one, and because we included that in our staging the parameters for the anthropometric part too, is because what data we have out there, and that's what makes it kind of nice that it's an easy one number, but we don't have enough data for everybody else.
Yeah.
I think for all that
the
expected ethnic differences for waist circumference and BMI, but the data we have so far kind of is like, okay, that's actually a pretty reasonable across the board number, which makes it easy, but also not perfect either. It's all right.
Yeah. Another thing that I saw was, as this definition has, as people have started to implement this definition, some have had to use, we'll say, a modified definition. That's kind of what they called it, because not everyone has access to data for all of these domains. So some, they might only have half of them, and they have to use a modified definition. There was one paper in children that mentioned in the paper that operationalizing this definition was difficult. It was complex. So as it begins to be implemented and used, we'll start to learn more and more about, hey, these were some positives, these were some negatives, things we need to figure out. Because like there was one study that used the NHANES sample from the 2017 to 2018 NHANES sample, and 98.4% of participants that were classified as with obesity by BMI, they also had excess adiposity by DEXA when using the Lancet definition. So that paper was kind of like, well, there's probably not much more of a benefit to using this new definition. Not everyone has access to DEXA either. We could just use BMI. And then another paper found something opposite, where there was a greater benefit to add in those anthropometric measures like waist circumference. And so there's a lot of variability so far in what's been found. And as more and more people use it, I think we'll start to learn more and more about, like, hey, maybe one, we need to revise it or move towards, like you said, another staging system. Or we're just learning a lot as it begins to be implemented.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's why, is my audio good enough, Spencer? You were just telling me it sucks.
It sounds better. It sounded choppy for a live, like static or something. I don't know. People are going to complain.
So with, like the way I like to talk about with our ACE staging system, and the Lancet Commission was being published while we were working on this. So we had to kind of scramble and somehow, make it connected a little bit, because it's the same basic concept. What they were trying to say with preclinical obesity is you have the anthropometric obesity. We say the same thing. We use BMI to, you can screen and classify, but use your physical exam to see, does it actually reflect excess adipose tissue? Use waist circumference, waist to height, body composition if you need to. But then, we talk about staging the clinical severity of obesity is more important. So rather than saying preclinical, because people were really concerned that was going to turn people off from understanding the disease state of it. And like what you said, even if you really do have what we call stage one obesity or preclinical obesity, it's not a benign state. It does tend to progress metabolically to unhealthy states. And there are other problems with it, like physical limitations, and not to mention the downstream risk of obesity-related malignancies. So we were all worried that people were going to not think of preclinical obesity as a disease when it is. It's just not as severe of a disease at the moment. So that's why we have our stages 1, 2 through 3, rather than preclinical and clinical, but they're the same basic concepts to some degree,
Yeah, no, that's a good point. I think
in the diabetes thing, like that's a crazy thing. So like, one or maybe two criteria of pre-diabetes would be kind of in that stage 2 sort of severity, but it's not stage 1 or preclinical obesity, or shouldn't be. And type 2 diabetes, if you have that diagnosis, you're already more severe. And you require more aggressive intervention to ameliorate the consequences of type 2 diabetes, which for some reason would be preclinical in their definition, which is another thing that just everyone was like, what? That doesn't make any sense. And it almost seemed like a mistake or something. But
a lot of people, we heard a lot of people were fighting about it. There are tons of people on it. There were a lot of fights about it. And
well, there are a lot of cooks in the kitchen. Speaking of, I mean, Garvey was on it too, so he and I were chairing the ACE allergy. So we had really close insight while that was being published. And it was just hard to reconcile, but we did the best we could because again, the concept is reasonable, but
So you did this. I mean, what'd you guys find? Is there metabolically healthy obesity? What was kind of your conclusion of this?
After reading, I don't even know how many papers I read. No, I mean, I remember when I was just starting with the review. So I created an outline of the different sections. I sent it to Dr. Robinson, and one of the sections was clinical implications, which is still in there. And I had like bullets to say like what I was going to talk about. And I remember one of his comments was like, by clinical implications, I forgot how he asked it, but he said, we might need to either delete this or just make it really short, because we know that these people don't have a lower risk of all-cause mortality or something than metabolically unhealthy obesity. We know than metabolically healthy normal weight people. We know that this phenotype doesn't really exist and it's just transitory. From what I read, maybe you have your I'll say this. Okay. Metabolically healthy obesity. Some of the research is showing that if somebody, let's say as a child, they're consistently someone metabolically healthy, obese child, and their cardiometabolic markers stay in the healthy range as a child, they have a better chance of maintaining that phenotype for much longer if they start if they start in that phenotype. That's what the research is showing. But other than that, it seems like it's not really a thing. I guess unless somebody, let's say they're classified as metabolically healthy obesity, by the definition of they don't have any components of metabolic syndrome. We have to go by that strict definition. If they're classified as that and they make an intentional effort to, like, let's say, lose some fat or something, they start exercising, changing the way they eat, and they're making an intentional effort, then maybe it can be a thing. Maybe it can be a thing because they're making a, they're putting forth some action to prevent the transition.
Yeah.
But other than
if you don't, that's kind of the key. If you don't treat it, see, you know, we talk about, well, let's say stage one or preclinical obesity. Again, the concern was that then we wouldn't be treating that as a disease when the risk of it, you know, and the genetics are play a huge role into who is at risk. That's, you know, talk about ethnic differences because there are, you know, different genetic predispositions to that cardiometabolic risk, let alone other risks of different levels of adipose tissue dysfunction and all that stuff. So that's where the staging and all that can help us. But even someone with preclinical obesity or stage one obesity, oftentimes they're, because it's already rare, right? Oftentimes they are going to be younger and they're going to be people who have maybe been putting in the effort for dietary quality and fitness. And we always say, even if people, especially those degrees of obesity, if they, even if they don't lose weight, but they do their improved nutrition and their exercise, and they're actually treating that adiposity-based disease process, right? They're preventing the progression of the health problems, which is actually what we care about. Mm-hmm. So they don't even have to have weight loss per se. They're treating their disease to prevent future complications, but a little bit of weight loss goes a long way into helping prevent that too, though.
Yeah. So for example, I mean, I have some patients that have way more adipose tissue than I have, but they, I exercise a lot, but they exercise more than I do. And they're just machines. Mm-hmm. They're doing Ironman competition types of things, despite more adipose tissue than I have. And their numbers, you know, their lipids and metabolic numbers look better than mine in certain regards. Mm-hmm. Now, the question is, can they keep that up over time? I don't know, because then you get into the physical limitations. But
there may be other problems that come down the road from it, but they're doing a great job keeping themselves as healthy as possible. That's so it's part of the critical treatment plan that maybe gets too lost. Obviously, we're the docs who lift. We want everyone working hard on their exercise and nutrition.
These are unicorn-ish patients, by the way. It's not common I see that, but I do have some just absolute rock star patients where I'm like, whatever. I mean, it's amazing. So I think the big thing here is, like, you see the fitness professional and fitness people going, they don't say if you have obesity, they're like, if you're fat, if you're obese, you're going to die sooner and whatever. And I don't think that's necessarily helpful. On the other hand, it's also not helpful to say, you can be healthy at every size. I always say you can be healthier at every size by doing all of those things. So even if a patient, it'll be really interesting. Your patients, actually, we have some patients with 60 BMIs and they have amazing glycemic marker. I'm just like, this person has not even an iota of a sign of even pre-diabetes. It's amazing. And you know,
necessarily matter, though. That's why a thinner person with more abdominal obesity and genetic predisposition, they have some of the highest risk of diabetes, heart disease, and stuff. So it's not
so
BMI.
So I mean, what I always say is, like, look, if you take someone who's metabolically healthy obesity, but like, which is rare, and they're just doing all the things I'm talking about, a lean counterpart, exactly the same but leaner, still likely has a less risk of developing cardiovascular disease and these other things down the road. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But having said that, like if we're doing all the things we can from a practical clinical outcomes standpoint, then like we're just doing the best we can. And that's what you should strive for, and not to use it as to shame people like, see, you're going to die earlier. It's like, well, we're doing what we can mm-hmm. here. So anyway, what are your next research? What's the next research on this? Are you going to do kind of some of this? And like, are you going to look for if there's anything in the extreme obesity, 60 BMI and above?
So what you just said about some BMI 60 people with good glycemic index and everything, what you just brought up exactly what I was going to mention. So I mentioned like the surgeons that are on this project and helping with this project. One of them mentioned, he was like, you know, it's the craziest thing because I have somebody that's like a BMI 70 and they're all their markers. You would not know that they are this heavy based off their markers because everything is in a healthy range. And then like, I think he told me one time recently, he was like, yeah, she was like BMI 74 or something. And I was looking at her blood work and I was like, there's nothing wrong with her. And the only thing that I guess was wrong was she had sleep apnea. And like, so if it wasn't,
that gets to the threshold, the adipocyte threshold of expandability. And that there's a lot of genetics to that. And so
mostly genetics.
So he would say, you know, it's actually not that uncommon for me to see these people. And we were talking about my inclusion exclusion criteria for the study. We were talking about, we were thinking about diabetes. And he said, it's kind of wild because I'll commonly come across these high BMI individuals and they don't have diabetes. And, because initially we assumed that they would, and he told us that. We were like, oh, okay, let's think about this. But yes, definitely a genetic component.
Very, very, very healthy functioning adipose tissue. Healthy adipose
tissue. Yeah, that's what Sam Klein is, the kind of guy that your mentor was debating at the obesity week. He's the guy that kind of looks at the genomics and the metabolomics and all these different things. It's really fascinating, but if you're blessed with the right genes and you store your fat in places and are able to continue to expand your fat tissue in the right places.
Waiting for a joke to pop up there, but okay.
I don't need to do any jokes.
No, we can't get fired anymore.
No, I'm the CEO.
Same with me in my clinic, I guess.
Yeah.
Funny enough.
He could.
Dr. Abbasin, what could I do? A joke?
You can get fired. So don't say anything. Fired, so
they won't fire me. I'm the personality hire here. They actually had Dr. Robinson and Sam Klein debate at the ADA conference as well on if muscle loss to GLP-1s is not.
Yeah. Okay. Can you give us a brief? Did you see it? Because I actually saw that saw the title of it. And I was like, oh, I wonder what they said. Because I have my thoughts of it. And we have our
the conclusion.
Thoughts.
I don't remember which side he was on. So they both agreed on the same thing, but the ADA was like, we want y'all to do this debate. So they had to pick a side. My thing is when people have this debate, the first question we need to ask is what's the metric we're talking about? What are we assessing? Because everyone uses muscle and lean mass interchangeably. And that's the first thing that's like, it ruffles my feathers that they just use muscle and lean mass.
I'm like, it's appropriate, perfect. You know what I mean? Like, and a lot of authors out there in the medical world make that unfortunate, you know.
That's why we have Grant who gives us all the specific definitions for anybody listening.
Well,
you know, it's actually fat-free mass that you see. Anything that's not fat, that's on a DEXA scan when they do these. But then muscle's only a component of that, but it also can include glycogen and all sorts of different things. But it's not lean mass. It's not the correct term.
And adipose tissue has water and blood vessels and protein.
Yes.
complicated. Lean mass is, if you're talking historically, you can use lean mass. But other than that, lean body mass and fat-free mass chemically are the same thing. Lean mass and lean soft tissue, you should also clarify when you use lean soft tissue, because that's not the same. But people don't we use fat-free mass as a proxy for skeletal muscle mass, but in the reference man, skeletal muscle mass was half of what fat-free mass was. So there's a decent discrepancy there. And then, so you got to ask, what are we assessing? What are we estimating here? Then we have to ask, okay, let's compare caloric restriction, low energy diet to, let's just look at a low energy diet, caloric restriction. How much fat-free mass would you typically lose? Okay, then let's look at these incretins. How much did they lose? It's about the same. Oh no. So.
And then of course, muscle quality, physical function, quality of life, all those things.
Yeah.
Lift some weights.
So we talked about this. Peter Attia was on one of these nighttime shows, Peter Megyn Attia Kelly, I think. And he was the one that kind of sounded the alarm and was fear mongering on Megyn Kelly's show a few years ago. We made a podcast right away with Dr. Tinsley, a few of them. But I was making fun of people on Twitter because I'm like, oh no, they lost lost some fat free mass. But they, you know, who cares? I guess that they reduce their risk of a heart attack and all these different things.
And they're more functional, and they're exercising more. And it turned out that their muscle quality and muscle mass wasn't actually worse in the further research.
So, in the end, we want people to lift weights and get healthier and fitter. But if they're not going to do that, you know, they're still going to get healthier regardless. So whatever.
They're probably going to be more physically active as it turns out. So it's all good. Vicious cycle going in the right direction.
Yeah. I actually posted on my close friend's Instagram story a couple nights ago this rant, because it was really starting to get to me. Because I mentioned I work on clinical trials here. So I talk to, like y'all do, I talk to people on GLP-1s every single day. And some of these people, you can see the hope, like in their eyes and their voice when they talk, because they're finally losing weight. And what just gets to me is the whole negative connotation around people using these drugs, just because mainstream media, you see, like, yeah, there are people using them that aren't supposed to. There are people abusing them, getting them on the gray market, whatever. But we have real human beings here that need them, and it's, one, saving their lives. It's giving them hope. And so that's something that's really been getting to me, is I'm talking to these people and they're just so thankful and appreciative to be able to finally make progress and lose weight. But they're scared to tell people because they fear that they'll automatically be judged, like, oh, they cheated, they took a shortcut. If they were available when I tried to lose weight, who knows? I might have taken that route. So that's just something that that's always gone to me, is people thinking it's cheating or a shortcut. But when we have something, some other condition like hypertension or something, blood pressure medication, they don't look at it like that, or diabetes.
Yeah. All the obesity related diseases that we can treat or prevent, they don't see that for some reason. They don't. It's infuriating.
Very cool, man. Well, we appreciate you coming on the podcast. And basically, you know, for anybody listening, like, look, you know, as we've said before, metabolically healthy obesity, if it exists, it's extremely rare, and it doesn't change what we want to do. Yes, if you have a more unhealthy obesity phenotype, is what we call it, but basically more issues from your obesity, we are a little bit more aggressive. But in the end, this is why I say, you know, I don't think we should be holding back on the GLP-1 medicines just for those at a higher risk. I think we should be treating it before it becomes more of an issue later down the line. And also, even if you use the medicine and you get down to a place to where you're not, ripped like Dr. Rodriguez from his lineman days, and now where he's at. But like, even if you don't get out of that anthropometric obesity, you're doing all the things you can, You're going to be better off than if you didn't. Where can people find you?
Hold on, wait. I can't let you get away with just that last.
No, yep, that's the final word.
This is our debate. You are the GLP or GTFO. We need to give a
GLP-1 or GTFO.
Right, but that's I would argue that that's inappropriate because they're expensive and they're intensive therapies and they're one type of medication. You don't have to use those. There are other medications.
The best, Jerry. Right. Best.
Well, whatever. But that we have other medications. Other
we'll
things.
We'll give it to them from the bathtub. If the FDA didn't get
No, there are cost considerations. Different people have different contraindications, different desires, and not everybody. And that's why the severity of the staging system helps. Because, yeah, the people at the more severe stages, not BMI, people at the more severe stages definitively should have those more first line and recommended. Whereas the lower stages, lower BMI, they may not need that, and so
they should be on. Everyone should be on Retta.
That's what the influencers selling it out of their bathtubs think.
That's right.
Dr.
Rodriguez.
We might have some more Retta results soon.
Perfect. Ooh. We're gonna have to have you back.
Is this an actual debate between y'all?
Yeah.
He
thinks everyone in the world should be on GLPs.
Because they've tried all the
fentanyl. That's not necessarily true. There's a broad spectrum of response to therapy and indications and cost considerations. But whatever. What an answer.
Most people have tried the crappy Contraves. QCMia, some people haven't. So I do a lot of QCMia.
Yeah,
Contraves and the other ones, it's like, ugh, it's not even going
to happen. And don't forget about surgery, too. Not enough people are
surgery, but people don't. Trust me, I try to get people to have surgery.
That's more cost-effective than the medicines we have right now, according to all the data we have. So
my patients get pissed when I bring up surgery, and I'm like, okay, hold on. Okay, I'm not forcing. I'm just throwing it out there.
Comprehensive care. We have multiple tools in our armamentarium now. We're lucky.
People want GLP-1 or GTFO. Where can people find you, Dr. Rodriguez, on Instagram?
I can tell y'all are brothers. Instagram, I think it's just Christian Rodriguez. _Christian_Rodriguez_.
We'll put it in the show notes. But thanks. You have some clinical trials you're working on. We'll try to get you back on with those. For anybody, make sure you go listen to the one with Dr. Heimsfeld, who Dr. Rodriguez is working with right now. He's a lucky guy to get to work with that team.
He probably stopped by during this meeting and then saw I was in a meeting and went back.
Nice. Very good, everyone. Well, if you have a friend or family member kind of understanding whether you can be, metabolically healthy while having obesity, make sure you send them this podcast. Until next time, here is our outro.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities. We'll be right back.